Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest leaks in The Guardian from Edward Snowden on the eve of the G8 summit in Northern Ireland, revealing that the British equivalent of the NSA, GCHQ, spied on delegations at a previous G20 summit put on by the same hosts back in 2009. Media critic and author Robert McChesney joins us to discuss the continuing spy scandal in the context of a military digital complex embedded in a commercialized internet controlled by compliant monopolies who serve the national security state. We will also discuss Robert McChesney's latest book, Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. Then Jonathan Alter joins us in the studio. He is a columnist for Bloomberg View and an analyst and contributing correspondent for NBC News and MSNBC. One of the foremost chroniclers of the Obama presidency, Alter wrote The Promise, President Obama, Year One. And he's now revealed the behind-the-scenes drama of the last part of Obama's first term and his successful re-election in his latest book, just out, The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. We'll discuss the book and the latest CNN poll showing Obama's approval rating is falling as a result of the recent scandals, both real and phony, with a particularly damaging 17-point decline over the past month among a key group of Obama supporters under 30. I'm now joined by Robert McChesney, who is the Gutskill Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's written several books on media and politics, hosts the weekly talk show Media Matters, and along with John Nichols, co-founded the media reform organization Free Press. He is the co-author with John Nichols of The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again, as well as a new book, Just Out, Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. His other books include Will the Last Reporter Turn Out the Lights, The Collapse of Journalism and What Can Be Done to Fix It, and his latest, Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert McChesney.
My pleasure, Ian.
And I've been covering the Snowden story with an NSA person who was quite senior, and also former CIA officer Bob Baer. And the story that so far that they've been getting, which is separate from what the press has been fixating on, which is the old and familiar civil liberties versus national security arguments. They both were saying how much money is the taxpayers being swindled, that these vast bureaucracies and the contractors, I mean, the contractors are really where the money's going, the privatization of intelligence. It's an amazing scandal. And one of the things that William Binney, an ex-NSA official, told me was that all of these companies that you've been looking into, the Googles, Facebooks, AT&T, Comcast, Microsoft, etc., they get paid by the NSA and by Booz Allen for what they hand over to them. They're not doing this. So, again, the taxpayer is getting hosed.
And, yeah, I'm glad you're covering the story this way, because this is really the only way to make sense of this story. And if we're going to change it, to see what sort of changes we're going to have to make. But, yeah, there's a ton of money in spying, and the companies like Google and Facebook, all the ones you named, that make a living by collecting everything you do online, they have great value there to sell to the government. And they are not doing this as do-gooder citizens or as a charity. They are making money off of these operations. And much of the politics behind the CISPA bill, which I suspect you've covered on this show, which was, you know, how much spying was going to be allowed on the Internet in Congress, much of the debate over that behind the scenes was really about how much these companies would get paid, how much, whether they could be forced to do it. You know, the negotiations were at a high level between these large semi-monopolies or monopolies that have gargantuan power and with the federal government.
So where do we stand then in terms of the last bit of the electronics, which is net neutrality? My understanding, I had Reed Hunt recently, former FCC chair out at the UCLA Hammer Forum recently, and he was saying that the real battle over this court in Washington that Obama's been trying to get these three people and they filibustered these previous nominees. The District of Columbia Court of Appeals. That the real issue that's behind the scenes in the Republicans filibustering these candidates for that court that Obama's trying to fill is that they don't want those extra votes on this key issue of net neutrality that's coming up in the fall. And if they don't get these people on the court, this Republican-dominated court will rule in favor of these big telecoms. Is that your understanding?
Well, I mean, let's just back up for the sake of listeners who might not be completely up to speed on net neutrality. It's basically the principle that people have come to expect from the Internet, at least the wired Internet, which is that all websites have equal access, all users have equal access to an audience. The ISP, which is generally an American now monopoly owned by the cable company or the phone company, can't sort of cherry-pick which websites get through and shake down others for money if they want to get through. And, of course, Verizon, AT&T, and Comcast despise it because they can make a fortune as soon as they can basically say they can turn the Internet into cable TV and say websites have to pay us to get that high-speed access. And people don't understand the severity of the issue because we have net neutrality for the most part. And the Obama policy, the problem with it, the one the FCC came down with a year and a half ago, is that it has pretty good net neutrality for wireline cable access. But for the smartphones and for the cell phone services, it has a Swiss cheese net neutrality. Basically, it doesn't exist. And when you've got two different policies like that, something has to give, and in all likelihood, we'll lose net neutrality altogether at some point. And this is a huge problem because we only have two or three companies that are largely the ISPs, both for cell phone and cable, and they don't compete. It's the most monopolistic system imaginable. And because of that, you have no alternative. It gives them tremendous leverage to privatize the Internet. And that's what's at stake here, so people understand the context. And, yes, the Republican Party is a wholly owned subsidiary of AT&T, which is leading the fight in Verizon and Comcast, and they will do everything in their power to try to even prevent the flawed Obama policy. The Obama administration has magnified the problem, or the Obama FCC. They could eliminate a lot of the problem by reclassifying Internet access as a telecommunication and not an information service, then they would have this whole court case would largely be moot, but they've been unwilling to do that.
So let's talk then, Robert McChesney, again, the author of the new book, Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against the against Democracy, in terms of both the use of the Internet by the NSA revealed in these leaks from Edward Snowden and the extent to which already these companies like Google, et cetera, collect enormous amounts of data on people. The reason you have Gmail for free is that the trade-off is that they get to learn all about you. So what you're telling us, though, is that the combination of these two, this government and private intrusion, is already happening and that it's already metastasized.
You know, one of the things I write about in Digital Disconnect, and I finished that book in December, I think, November, December, and it was in print in March. But if you read the section of the book I have, basically nothing that came out in The Guardian in the last week would be a surprise. I mean, this is really widely known by people who looked at and studied it, that everything we do online is known by these companies. We don't have access to hardly any of what they know about us. And that the government is routinely taking this and cooperating with these big firms and paying them to know what they want to know. So this, in one sense, wasn't an enormous surprise. And it was sort of what was shocking how it was completely not a news story. That being said, it simply didn't register, largely because elites in both parties, Republican and Democrat, have completely signed off on this policy and don't want to mess with it. You know, I don't know if that gets at what you're trying to for me to talk about, Ian, but I mean, it points, I think, to the, and I think your coverage of this story gets at it, that this is not just about a big state that's being obtrusive against the citizenry. It's a far more daunting story. It's a story about a large, unaccountable national security complex with a $1 trillion budget for all the military and security spending. We have about the same as the rest of the world combined. It's virtually completely unaccountable to Congress, to elected officials, and certainly not to the public, gets almost no press coverage to speak of, and it's in cahoots with private industry, these large semi and thorough monopolies that dominate online. And it leads us to just really an existential problem for a self-governing people, for a constitutional system. And it was Milton Friedman, the noted conservative, who was the most adamant about this. The genius of capitalism for democracy, he said, was that power was fully separate between politics and economics. And in the economic realm, it was highly competitive. So it was diffused power, and you didn't have to worry about concentration. What we have now is the exact opposite. We have a handful of massive monopolies. 13 of the 30 most valuable companies in the United States today are internet monopoly companies, like all the ones you just named, working surreptitiously on unaccountable policies of the government obsessed with surveillance of the population. This is not a tenable situation for a constitutional rule.
And the idea that the combined commercial and governmental power of intrusion to find out everything about you, your life, both for economic and political reasons, should be. It's as though we're really taking on a massive battle here. I mentioned net neutrality, which will, if that goes down, which it may well, then they've got an absolute free reign, and the last bit of the electronics commons are gone. So, I mean, it feels in many ways daunting to try and wake up the public about how far behind the curve we are. And I suppose we can be thankful at least that we're talking about it. This, I mean, it's just pretty shocking to think that everything's up for grabs, except, of course, the only one thing that you're free to do in America anymore is to have as many firearms as you want.
You know, it's our news media have been dreadful on this. But, you know, some media have picked it up with the Snowden revelations, which, again, weren't entirely revelations, but with that story breaking at The Guardian. And there's been some good editorial support. But in general, I would say the core problem of our journalism covering stories like this is that our Washington, D.C. journalists and our mainstream news media take their cues from the range of legitimate debate by what's being debated by those at the heights of the Republican and Democratic Party, who are both completely in bed with the military-industrial complex, with $1 trillion of spending, with the spying program. And the only people who are sort of dissidents are sort of the backbenchers in both parties, but primarily the Democratic Party, who oppose this. And it means that working journalists, just following their professional code, end up regurgitating what's seen as legitimate by elites and disparaging that which elites disparage, because they do it as a consensus forum. And it means our journalism in cases like this becomes propaganda for the most part. It's really unacceptable for giving citizens the information they need to govern themselves and not be governed surreptitiously by a security state.
And do you think it's a case, just in the last minute or so, Bob McChesney, do you think it's a case that people won't know what they've lost until it's gone?
I hope not. You know, I'm an optimist by nature. What always gives me tremendous source of hope is that I think that when people get a sense of what's at stake and what the options are, this is a relatively progressive country, and far more progressive today than it was 30 years ago, certainly. And so I'm optimistic. I think, you know, one of the things that makes this system seem successful is that people know so little about it, and they're given just little opportunity to engage in a debate on it. Certainly neither party is pursuing such a debate. So it's awfully hard in the political realm to do so, and our journalism that exists has done a woeful job. But when people actually do hear about it, when you talk to people and they read about it, I think there's tremendous concern across the political spectrum with the monopolization of the Internet on one hand, with the increase of unlimited, unaccountable spying on the other hand, and then a recognition that the marriage of those two things is nothing short of a disaster for a free society.
Well, Robert McChesney, I thank you so much for joining us.
My great pleasure, Ian.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert McChesney, who is the Gutskill Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois and Urbana-Champaign. He's written several books on media and politics and hosts the weekly talk show Media Matters. And along with John Nichols, he wrote Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. That's a book that's just out. And his latest book is Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with Jonathan Alter. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Jonathan Alter, a columnist for Bloomberg View and an analyst and contributing correspondent for NBC News and MSNBC. He's a former senior editor and columnist for Newsweek, where he worked for 28 years. His books include The Promise, President Obama Year One, The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days, and The Triumph of Hope, both New York Times bestsellers. And his latest book just out is The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Alter.
Thanks very much, Ian.
And today, CNN have come out with a poll that suggests that President Obama, his approval rating, which stands at 45%, is down 8 points in 1 month from 53%. And the most dramatic drop in his support is a 17-point decline over the past month among people under 30. So what's happening to his popularity and his presidency? And because there's also some rather negative figures about the trust factor, which has always been, I think, a strong point that Obama's had.
Right. And those things were his ace in the hole in 2012. So these are very troubling findings for him in terms of his ability to get certain kinds of things done. But they're much less troubling than they would have been if they had taken place a year ago and we now had, you know, perhaps had Mitt Romney as president as a result. So he's not going to face the voters again. And I think that we're all maybe a little bit too conscious of – we're sort of addicted to polls. One of the things I deal with in my book is how wrong a lot of polls are. I don't think these are wrong, but a lot of other ones were horribly inaccurate in 2012. But I think that this indicates that there has been a real erosion in trust as a result of the confluence of, you know, four or five controversy scandals, whatever you want to call them, right in the same period. And different ones of these are more troubling to different sectors, but combined they have dented him. And the only thing that is clear is that a president has a lot of resources with which to rebound depending on how he responds to subsequent events. And there have been periods where he was quite low in the, you know, he was down at 45% or below, even a little below in the middle of 2011 when he seemed so inept in the debt ceiling crisis. But the trust figures and the figures with young people are new. And, you know, for anybody who wants to see Obama remembered as a very good president, this will make it a little bit tougher if those numbers hold up. But the thing about polls is that they're always changing. It's a little bit like the weather. If you wait long enough, they change.
Well, isn't it fairly necessary, in effect, for the president to run again in next year? I mean, off-term elections tend to go against the incumbent.
Right.
We saw the blowout in 2010, which I think caught all the Democrats in the White House by surprise. If that happens again, then his presidency is effectively over. He's launching Obamacare this year. And if it works, I think he can run on that. If it doesn't work, well, the Republicans are going to run on it at any rate, I'm sure. Run against
it. If they run another campaign against Obamacare, I think they're making a mistake unless it turns out to be a complete disaster in implementation. You know, Obamacare helped Obama in 2012, particularly with Latino voters, but overall more people in exit polls supported it. The real challenge for him in 2014 is turnout. So 2010, where my book starts with the disastrous for Democrats results of 2010, about 80 million Americans voted, down from 130 million in 2008. Then in 2012, it was back up to 125 million. So whether that 45 million will show up or not in 2014 will determine whether the Democrats can defy history and actually hold their own. Usually in the sixth year of a presidency, it's terrible for the party that controls the White House. But I think the biggest factor will be the economy. I think there'll be two big factors in 2014. The biggest, which is always the biggest, is the economy, and the other is immigration reform. So if Republicans don't do immigration reform and the Democrats can run against them as obstructing immigration reform, then a lot of the Latinos who stayed home in 2010 but came out in 2012 might be willing to come out again and punish the Republicans for obstructing. And if they don't, if immigration does pass and they don't come out, that would be good for Republicans. So anybody who's a Republican should be for immigration reform out of pure self-interest and, in fact, isn't thinking clearly about the future of their party. They don't have to win a majority of Latino votes, but they have to do better than 29%, which is what they got in the 2012 election.
But again, it looks like he's got to get the people out. That was my premise
and that's
there.
And he seems to be
the draw. They're so dysfunctional, though. We have never had a government, I don't think, in the history of this republic, that is this broken, this polarized, and this dysfunctional. And can't he run on that? Can't he run on the idea that we'll never get anything done unless you get the obstructionists out?
I think he should be more confrontational on that. And he did do some of that in 2012. He should return to that. But I think, again, I hate to return again to immigration reform, but if they get that done, that's not so dysfunctional. That's a major piece of legislation. And that might condition some of the conversation next year. And a lot of it also depends on what I devoted a lot of space in the center holds to, which is the state of the Democrats, state of the Democrats' advantage in digital technology. And everybody knows that they have what I call a geek gap over the Republicans when it comes to understanding how digital technology can change politics. But I wanted to explain how, what were the tools they built? How did they do this? And it's not all transferable to 2014 when Obama's not on the ticket. And David Plouffe, the president's who had been one of the president's top advisors, told me that he wasn't expecting that a lot of it can be directly transferred. But they do have an organization that is built on the 2012 Organizing for America, Obama for America campaign. It's called Organizing for Action. They kept the OFA. And, they start with 20 million email addresses and a very vital infrastructure of field organizations in battleground states that will first be involved in immigration reform. And then even if they have to leave that organization for sort of legal reasons, will be involved in the 2014 campaign. And they did an amazing job. There were more blacks who turned out in Ohio in 2012 than 2008. So all that talk about the enthusiasm gap, people are tired of Obama, blah, blah, blah. When it came time to vote, they understood the stakes and that this was what I call a hinge of history, that this was a pivotal election about whether we were going to take a very sharp turn to the right. And, you know, I think that there are a number of people who are in what you could call the Obama coalition of young people, although maybe that's now changing given some of this new polling, African-Americans, Latinos, better educated people who recognize that the Republicans might not have gotten the message in 2012 and it might take another election. And so in something like background checks or common sense gun safety, the only way that any of that is going to move in a significant way is if progressives feel as strongly about it as the NRA does on the other side and punish some people at the polls. And so if you have some members of Congress who are on the wrong side of public opinion and don't live in deep red rural counties but are in more sort of suburban counties and they lose, then suddenly that creates the political space for change on that issue, because until now the only people losing on that issue have been pro-gun control people. So it's all about what happens at the ballot box, and that's the only reason that immigration is even on the table right now.
But the president has had, I think, a growing problem with his left and with the progressives in this country.
It's true.
To the extent that, you know, he wasn't the miracle worker they expected, and maybe these new polls indicate a defection as a result of this NSA stuff. Continuing in the news, and on this day, of course, he was embarrassed on the eve of the meeting with the Chinese President Xi, and now the G8 summit, this leak comes out on the eve of that as well. So you know this man, and you've chronicled Obama in this current book, The Center Holds Obama and His Enemies, and the previous book, The Promise, President Obama, Year One. Within the man himself, is there a struggle between the constitutional law professor and the commander-in-chief?
It's a great question. There's no question that there is that struggle, and you could see it in the speech they gave at the National Defense University a couple of weeks ago. His first job as president is to defend the United States, and something that a lot of people don't quite confront is that you can't find needles if you don't have a haystack, and you can't connect dots if you haven't assembled the dots. So a program like PRISM is necessary if you're going to prevent terrorism. But what happened was these programs became unaccountable, and the checks and balances, the constitutional checks and balances, the transparency that Obama promised has been not entirely lacking, because he did sign a couple of executive orders that improved transparency, but it's been significantly less than what it needs to be. And so it's going to be interesting seeing him recalibrate a little bit now that it's become a big public issue. Remember, a lot of this was known in 2005 when the first stories on this came out, didn't get as much publicity. There's also a lot of misinformation, like this claim by Edward Snowden that he could eavesdrop on the president if he wanted to at any time, which is not true. And so, you know, the public sees this in some ways in a threatening context, although the polls show that most people are willing to pay this price to stay secure. So he needs to strike that balance between freedom and security better, and more on the side, I would say, of freedom. But other people have to, on the left, have to be sensitive to the idea that just because we haven't been hit in 11 years doesn't mean that there aren't these genuine threats, and that if you're president, you have to deal with them, and you can't just pretend that they don't exist. But we need to know a lot more about these programs. The FISA court is unaccountable, much too secret. A lot of the secrecy is unnecessary. And so if it's – my basic point on is that if it's easier for the government nowadays to find out what's going on with the people – it should also be easier for the people to find out what's going on in the government. And these programs need to be much more transparent. The news of the last 6 weeks, I don't find the Benghazi story compelling. And there have been a lot of just lies that have been thrown up by the right wing on that story. The IRS story, to me, the problem was that they didn't investigate enough. They had these thoroughly political organizations like I have in the Center Holds. You know, Karl Rove made a filing to the SEC, to the IRS in 2010, where he claimed that his super PAC, 501c4 Crossroads GPS was not, quote, primarily interested in influencing elections. That was flatly untrue. Mm-hmm. They spent $70 million trying to influence elections. And
well, they operate under social welfare. That's
right. They operate under social welfare. I mean, what kind of a joke is that? Mm-hmm. You know, so the real problem was, yes, should they have been also investigating Democratic groups? Sure, if you're going to investigate Republicans, investigate Democrats. But that needed to be more aggressive. My problem in the stories of the last 6 weeks was the AP Fox News reporter, you know, who they said was a co – the FBI said was a co-conspirator. Once you start criminalizing investigative reporting – and I say this not just because I'm a reporter – I think you really have a problem in a democratic society when they, you know, start to go after the people who are gathering information about our government that we need to know.
Well, you mention in your book, Jonathan Alter, The Center Halls, Obama and His Enemies, this relationship that he has with the former president, Bill Clinton, the head of explaining stuff.
And you feel
like this president, who's an extraordinary communicator and an extraordinary orator, if he were able to, and he said he wants to have an adult conversation about our liberties versus national security, if he were more proactive like the war room that Clinton had, and see all these stories that you just mentioned, the IRS, for example, it turns out that ISA is way out in a limb and most of it has been hyped.
Right.
Benghazi is an entirely manufactured story.
Right.
You feel like you need somebody slapping this stuff down so that it doesn't get a life of its own. And
for example, the
filibuster, which is totally paralyzed its ability. Why do the Democrats frame that as the nuclear option to go back to business as normal? It's not a nuclear option. It's not Armageddon. It's going back to the way that the Republic operated for the last 200 years.
I think it's a great point, and that's a perfect illustration of their getting just lapped on communicating, and the Republicans for years have run linguistic circles around the Democrats. There's no reason why they should call it the nuclear option. There's no reason that when they stop judges, they shouldn't say this is a court shrinking plan. You know, instead they're saying it's not a court packing plan. You know, that's what the president said when he was just trying to fill unfilled vacancies on the U.S. District Court of Appeals. And so it's all in. Well, it's not what the Republicans say. It's, well, how about turning the tables and actually saying what it is and just being more muscular and having a war room. I've got a chapter, A Not-So-Great Communicator, where I explain some of the president's shortcomings in this area, especially on Obamacare, but in a number of other areas as well. And it's been one of the great surprises of his presidency. I have a scene where at one point Bill Clinton says, you know, what I don't understand about this president is he's so good at the hard stuff like foreign policy and so bad at the easy stuff like communicating with more than 10 people, you know, reaching out and making his case. So I offer some explanations for that. And campaigns are different than governing. But part of it is that he has a disdain for some of the theatricality of politics. Unfortunately for him, the presidency has always been a theater, and you have to operate in that theater and under the requirements, you know, of what Hyman Roth and The Godfather called the business we have chosen. You know, he's in politics. He's been enormously successful as the first president in 50 years, reelected twice with a elected twice with a majority, and yet he has this disdain that we all saw in that first debate. And I explain how in the debate prep he went 0-for-6 against John Kerry playing Mitt Romney and was freaking out his coaches and aides because they knew he was going to lose. And the reason is this disdain. And there are a lot of deeper explanations that I try to get at for why he disdains things about the business he's chosen.
Right. And Romney was the embodiment of all that disdain, wasn't
right.
he?
Right. So, and Romney, who – you know, I explain his failures as well. He brought out something in Obama, a contempt that Obama's debate coaches were afraid would spill out in that first debate. What they didn't realize is that the public was fine with that contempt spilling out. So when it spilled out, say, in the third debate, when he talked about, you know, this isn't a game of battleship, and was very cutting in ways that in the past would have been seen as unpresidential, everybody loved it on social media. You know, so I think they got more comfortable after that loss in the first debate with letting him take the gloves off a little more. I would urge that he do the same now as president and trust himself to really land a few blows, which would be gratifying not just to liberals, but would, I think, put him in a better position vis-a-vis the cut and thrust of politics in Washington. But he just kind of sees that as all silly and cable noise. And he is very focused on, you know, preparing for his meeting with, you know, other foreign leaders in Northern Ireland this week, you know, making sure that he knows exactly what he's going to say to Putin to get him to try to maybe ease off in Syria, or all the many complexities of his job. He's more focused on them than he is on trying to figure out how to deal with people he does not respect on Capitol Hill.
Well, let's take a brief station break, and we will continue the conversation with Jonathan Alter, the author of The Center Holds Obama and His Enemies. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm continuing the conversation with Jonathan Alter, a columnist for Bloomberg View and an analyst and contributing correspondent for NBC News and MSNBC. His latest book just out is The Center Holds Obama and His Enemies. Just before the break, you were saying that you would welcome him getting tough. What restrains him? One of the explanations is that he doesn't want to come across as an angry black man.
I think that's true. It sounds a little simplistic, but I think there's a lot of truth to that. And part of it is he has a more mild temperament from his upbringing in Hawaii. But I think that a lot of it is a sense, as one of his close aides put it, that there's some pitches he just can't swing at without playing into the old racial dynamic where, you know, they bait him, he responds, then they respond, then they're accusing each other of playing the race card, and suddenly he's back in the old dynamic that he couldn't stand and that he transcended when he was first elected president. In fact, when he was first elected to the Senate. So he doesn't want to get into that again. And, you know, I talked to a number of people who are very close to him about his relationship with race, and that's the kind of thing that he talks about a lot privately but not in public, and I tried to bring some of those scenes to light. I was intrigued, for instance, that he had a meeting with a series of black leaders, a group of black leaders in the Roosevelt Room, two meetings, both of which I have accounts of. And, you know, in the first one, there's some complaints that he doesn't have enough of a pro-black agenda. And he says, look, if I just said black, 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 that wouldn't do blacks very much good. We wouldn't be able to get any of it through Congress. But healthcare helps blacks. Food stamps helps blacks. And I can't, you know, and he says, I don't mind people having substantive disagreements on whether my agenda is good enough for blacks. And he goes on to argue why it was. But the only thing that really hacks him off is if they say he's not black enough, which is what Cornel West did. And I've got that whole struggle in the book. But then later on, after the election, he has a meeting with some of the same black leaders, and Al Sharpton, who's on his side on this particular question, said that he had just told a story about it. He just had lunch with a friend who had just converted to Islam, and the friend had a ham sandwich for lunch. And Sharpton said, you can't eat that. That's pork. And the guy said, no, I'm having a ham sandwich. And Sharpton says, well, just because it's not called pork doesn't mean it isn't pork. And then he turns to the president and says, and just because your agenda isn't called a pro-black agenda doesn't mean it isn't a pro-black agenda. And Obama says, I like the pork metaphor.
So what do you – you mentioned that the president, he's not focused on the daily polls and what the noise that goes out on the 24-hour cable. But on the other hand, you know, he's at the G8 summit and meeting with Putin, trying to work out some deal over Syria, which may be completely impossible. But the other big part of the agenda, of course, is that he's trying to tell the Europeans that austerity is a disaster, which they should know by now. And yet he has been, to some extent, drunk the Pete Peterson, the billionaire's Kool-Aid about the deficit. And I'm astounded. And you can see that the deficit has slowed down the recovery. I mean, this sequestration has slowed down the recovery. That's pretty obvious. But you wonder why the agenda – first of all, you wonder why. Maybe we get the government we deserve, but why so many people in America have drunk that Kool-Aid, why they think that this abstraction of the deficit is more important than a vigorous and growing middle class that the wages have been flat since the 70s. Let's focus on rebuilding the middle class.
Tried to. I mean, it took them too long to, after the signing of health care, to move to the jobs bill. It wasn't until September of 2011 that he came forward with a rejected austerity and came forward with a good jobs bill, which was rejected by the Republicans, even though they had, going back to the founding of their party in the 1850s, they had believed in infrastructure and rebuilding the country. And suddenly that was just wasteful spending to them. And it was clear that they didn't actually give a rat's patootie about the deficit when in the clown car debates in the Republican primaries, and they were asked, would you accept a 10-to-1 ratio of deficit reduction to tax increases? And they all, including Romney, said no. So even they didn't care about deficit reduction. The whole thing was phony. All they cared about was, as Grover Norquist said, shrinking the government so that it could be strangled in a bathtub. And Obama, after the drubbing that he took, the shellacking, as he called it, in 2010, he had to talk to them about deficit reduction. He needed to respond to a great concern at that point in the country, which was wrong, but a great concern about the deficit. There was some truth to it, which liberals don't often acknowledge, that with the baby boomers retiring, you know, there was some need for some advanced planning on reasonable modifications so that we wouldn't burden our grandchildren. But it got completely out of control. And after the debt ceiling fiasco in the summer of 2011, Obama realized, and I've got these scenes in my book where he, you know, he says that he just is going to campaign the way he wants to on what he thinks is important, which are these middle class issues that he described. So since that time, he hasn't been drinking any Kool-Aid that I've been able to see, but he's been obstructed. And the center holds tells the story of that obstruction, his ability to overcome it in getting reelected and in fashioning a middle-class message. But the book ends with the inauguration. So in terms of his, you know, inability this year, he got some things done at the end of the year. In terms of raising taxes on the wealthy again, but not as much as a lot of people would have hoped. What I would say to progressives, Ian, is that as bad as things are for him right now, it's important to look at the glass half full as well as half empty. Imagine how progressives would feel now if Romney were president. What would be going on with the economy improving is that the wide conclusion would have been Barack Obama was Jimmy Carter. He couldn't get it done. It wasn't until we got a business-friendly president in there who slashed taxes again for the wealthy, slashed regulations, slashed social programs, not by 5 or 10% like in the sequester, but under the Ryan plan, which would have gone through, by the way, by 50, 60, 70% or eliminated entirely, eaten all of our seed corn, stripped college loans out of the budget, all the rest, and there would have been a cause and effect. Look, we did all these Republican things. We elect a new president. Now the economy's going up. It would have discredited progressive ideas for a generation. So we dodged a huge bullet last year. And to me, I've covered 9 presidential elections, and this was the most significant. So when I say, you know, the title is The Center Holds, would it have been better? Would I have been happier if it was the left advances? Sure. But I'll take the center holds over a right-wing shift in this country to an unrecognizable country. And as, you know, as Warren Buffett, to quote him, you know, as he said when Romney started complaining that Occupy Wall Street was class warfare, he said, there's class warfare, all right. It's my class, the rich, against everybody else. Well, if Romney had won, that sort of victory, Buffett said, and we're winning. If Romney had won that victory of the banks and everything over the last 15 or 20 years, it would have become a rout, and we would be headed toward becoming a very different country. So Obama was kind of a small C conservative centrist who has defended and protected the accomplishments of the 20th century, the social contract and the progressive accomplishments of the 20th century, which had been accepted until now by Republicans, you know, not just entitlements, but and I don't like to call them entitlements, not, you know, not just social insurance, but infrastructure, investment in education, all the rest. He defended that successfully. So whatever his problems are right now, I just urge progressives to look at it in a larger historical context, and we're a hell of a lot better off than we would have been otherwise.
Well, indeed, the pivotal moment in the campaign, the 47% speech that was made and surreptitiously videotaped by a man who was motivated by – he couldn't believe that Romney was talking about these indentured Chinese women living 12 to a room, working like slaves, and Romney appeared to think that that was a good thing.
Yeah.
That, and this motivated this man to release this important view into him. But the
can I just talk about that for a second?
Yeah, sure.
Because, Ian, I'm really glad you raised that. That was the most interesting part of the center holds for me to report, was getting to know Scott Prody, who was the bartender who changed history. Not just because he helped Obama open up a 7-point lead, which was able to survive the disastrous first debate and gave him the cushion that he needed to win, not just because he helped him win, but because he represented this the class nature of the 2012 campaign. And he understood what was at stake. And it wasn't just the 47%. What really angered him was Romney praising a slave labor factory in China, and he assumed the identity of a young Chinese girl from the cover of a book called Factory Girl by Leslie Chang. And so when I would get emails from him when I first started communicating with him and first starting to get to know him, there would be instead of a 38-year-old burly bartender, white male bartender, it would be a picture of a young Chinese girl. And he now – I just got an email from him last week. He was hired by the steelworkers and their international labor committee, and he's in Bangladesh working on international labor issues. So after a very rough period – and I found his personal life absolutely fascinating, his coming to consciousness fascinating. After a rough period where he was unemployed – when I first got to know him, after you know, he had to leave the catering company, he's landed on his feet, and it's a great story. And I got very interested in his motivation. So he had saved a woman from who had plunged into a canal in the Everglades, and everybody else was standing around not rescuing her, and he jumped into this canal and he got the door open of the submerged car. He sliced the seatbelt, freed the woman. He was decorated as a hero. And 7 years later, you know, when
he saved America.
he did save America. And so I said, so what did you learn from that episode in the Everglades? And he said he learned if you can jump in, you must jump in. And that's what he did. He was determined to prevent Mitt Romney from becoming president after what he heard that night at the fundraiser.
Well, but just in terms of the challenge Obama has to keep a government going and not to have another blowout like 2012 next year, we'd mentioned that he's going to have to weigh in and join the fight. But the problem with the progressives is that quite more often than not, they're more angrier that the person that's likely to the right of them on the left becomes the target as opposed to the Tea Party on the far right. And my sense is that, again, if the president were able to have this adult conversation to explain why he can't get things done, why he's not the miracle worker, why, for example, from right out of the gate, he wasn't able to get the full stimulus. Amitai Etzioni has this theory that we see ourselves in terms of a dichotomy between the Democrats and Republicans, but really there's a small liberal party in this country and a larger conservative party, and that it's the Democrats who vote with the Republicans that frustrate Obama's progressive agenda. So is there any way that he can have that debate to get them off his back, the progressives off his back?
I mean, I think you've got two things in there, one of which I strongly agree with, and the other from my friend Amitai, I don't agree with. I don't think that the problem is that, liberals have been voting with conservatives. It's that what you described earlier, the rules of the Senate have been abused to allow a willful minority to thwart the will of the majority. And then what happened after 2010 was it was a census year. And so the Republicans who got control in a lot of state legislatures did two things. They redrew the lines so that even though Democrats got a million more votes than Republicans for the House of Representatives last year, they lost the House. They lost 55% of the seats. And the same Republicans in the state legislatures tried to rig the election with voter suppression bills in 19 states. And I tell that story in the Center Holds really for the first time in one place of how there was this concerted effort through these little-known organizations like the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, and other such organizations to rig the election. And it turned out not to work. And it's kind of an exciting story about why it didn't work. So I think it's that more than, you know, Democrats doing what they did in the Reagan era and, you know, voting with conservative Republicans all the time. But your other point, which is why doesn't the president have an adult conversation with the country and have maybe one of these televised town meetings where he explains some of these things? Now he doesn't have to run for reelection. He can just be himself. Why doesn't he, as he said, go Bullworth? You might have seen that in the paper a few weeks ago, like the Warren Beatty movie where the senator says exactly what he believes. I think that would be a really smart thing for him to do and to just put it all on TV. The Republicans don't want to go to those meetings, and so he should invite them because he does better than they do, and they did it in the first term. He should invite them. If they don't show, fine. Have a town meeting without them. Have other Democrats there and try to explain around a table on television what some of these concerns are. And he's not running again, so he might as well let it all hang out.
Well, do you think you could go Bullworth to the extent that you could have a conversation, a really adult conversation, about the extent to which, because of the enormous influx of money into politics, that we are becoming less of a democracy, more of an oligarchy? That one of the reasons why, for example, single payer was never embraced, I mean, there has to be a good reason for that, and that I assume is that Obama was just up against this huge power that he couldn't even find.
I mean, in terms of revisiting that, I first wrote in Newsweek in favor of single payer in the early 1990s. And, you know, so that's more than 20 years that I've been on record as a supporter of single payer. I was a big supporter of a public option. But I had a big row with my progressive friends in 2009 and 2010 because what they didn't recognize or were sort of willfully ignoring is that, universal coverage, giving everybody health care coverage as Obamacare does, goes back to the Progressive Party platform, Bull Moose platform of 1912, and that this president accomplished what seven presidents tried and failed to do. And because people do not study history very much, they don't recognize what a huge accomplishment this is with all of its inadequacies. And I wanted a public option. Right. But this is a big deal. And so I don't think he has to have a conversation with the American public where he you know, apologizes for not having single payer. I think what he should do in that conversation is explain more clearly what Obamacare is going to do and how maybe it does need to be fixed in some technical ways. On the banks, I would agree with you. I think he needs to explain, as his friend Dick Durbin told me when we talked about the banks in the Senate, and Durbin said, the banks own this place. Like, let's be honest about it, that a small – they tried on Dodd-Frank, but they did not succeed in curbing the power of the big banks. And the president knows it, and his explanation for it is that in 2000 – I don't think it's a convincing explanation – but that in 2009, when he had the leverage, he didn't use it because the banks were so brittle and we were losing 800,000 jobs a month. He made the same decision that Franklin Roosevelt made and that I cover in my earlier book about Roosevelt, not to nationalize the banks because he thought that it wouldn't be good for the economy in the middle of a crisis. And Roosevelt and Obama made the same decision. I'd like to see him defend that and talk about this oligarchy that you're mentioning. In terms of money in politics, he has been outspoken on Citizens United. He needs to return to that. He needs to put some muscle behind campaign, real – calling it campaign finance reform sounds too boring. You know, real reform of our corrupt and broken political system, but also explain to people that there's an – even in the current system, there's another way. So for instance – Romney's average contribution was over $1,000. Obama's average contribution was $66. I don't personally have any problem with money in politics as long as it's small money, not big money.
Or disclosed money.
And disclosed money is the critical thing. It has to be disclosed. The Republicans are complete hypocrites on that because for years when they were arguing against campaign finance reform, they said, well, all we're for is disclosure. But then suddenly when they're there's something called the Disclose Act that's up on Capitol Hill. They're against it, which they've done on a dozen other issues. It's too, as soon as Obama's for it, they're against it. But you know that would be a great conversation, Ian, and I think you're very on point that he should use part of his second term to have these adult conversations with the American public. And if he communicates better, I think progressives will see it a little more from his perspective. They won't think he's necessarily one of them. He's a pragmatic, slightly left of center guy, but he's probably about as progressive as we can expect in this country. And even at this moment of trouble for him, I think it would behoove progressives to look at the glass half full in at least some respects.
Well, Jonathan Alter, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Yeah. Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Alter, who's a columnist for Bloomberg View and an analyst and contributing correspondent for NBC News and MSNBC. He's a former senior editor and columnist for Newsweek, where he worked for 28 years. His books include The Promise, President Obama, Year One, The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days, and The Triumph of Hope, both New York Times bestsellers. And his latest book just out is The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time will last.